head from the chair. It's a short story. But I wasn't speaking on behalf of the chair. But we are going to start. I see that technology is also letting us down, but we are going to be taking with the annual report of the fires on board. And the team from the fires on board that at the present moment outnumbers the committee is going to take us through. And I trust that by the time we get to the second flight, the committee will have numbers that more or less equal your team. The team is led by the ombud himself, Mr. Charles Pillay, a familiar face indeed in this committee, with his deputy, Ms. Nolundu Bam. I am going to request that when you walk up, before you walk us through, you also introduce the other gentleman, because somebody with a terrible handwriting, worse than mine, actually wrote the names, and I don't want to pronounce people's surnames the way some people pronounce my own surname. it's good to have you here. It's one of those engagements. We've had a number of engagements with the fire zone, but in the past. But we take your work quite seriously, and it's very important, both in Parliament and in our constituencies. And that is why we felt, even though the workload of this committee does not allow us to actually engage with everybody that reports to us, but you were one of those that we had identified that we would definitely, before we rise, be quite keen to hear how you have fared in the financial part. So without wasting time, Mr. Pillay, we're all yours. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable Chair and Honourable Members of PCOF. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to present our annual report to you. As the Chair has requested, let me start by introducing colleagues. Ms. Bam, on my left, immediate left, is the Deputy Ombud. In terms of the FIVE Act, FIVE, standing for Financial Advisor and Intermediary Services, actually has certain powers which are similar to that of the Ombud, that being to write determinations and to sign off determinations. To the left of her is Mr. David Davidson, an assistant ombud. He too would prepare determinations for eventual signature by and vetting by the deputy and myself. Mr. Eugene Oakes on my far left is a case manager, and he deals with the bulk of cases that come in, both with a view to settling them and preparing the groundwork for what could eventually become a determination. I am sorry that the technology doesn't work. You have, I assume, before you a number of slides with pictures on them and graphics on them. We'll take you through them as we go along. But just by way of an introduction, this report is the fourth annual report of the FIVE Ombud, and I take it you have copies of them and have seen those reports. And as the Chair has indicated, our reporting to you in this manner is a good thing, that institutions like ours report widely on the work that it does. It's not only good for the system, as it engenders a commitment to public participation in important work relating to the governance of our financial services in this country. The report is also reflective of the work done by the FIVE Ombud. And I must say we're a new institution in the financial services landscape, and Parliament has seen it fit to call us to engage with you on this report. And as a public institution that performs what I'm sure you will all agree is a critical function in our young democracy, I think it is important that we share our work with you. This is not only done to enlighten and to educate a very important and relevant stakeholder, but also keeping with the very noble ideals of our constitution, that of transparency and public accountability. I don't believe it's necessary for me to take you through every bit of the report. What I think is important is that I give you some high-level areas and share with you some case studies. This is being done in order, Chair, to give the committee an insight on how we have grown and how we have developed in our work over the years. My colleagues will also talk to you on some areas of note and, of course, some areas of concern that we see in our work. Now, as said, this is our fourth annual report, but in real terms, we've only been 3 years in business. This committee may know that we started on the 30th of September 2004. That is the date on which we kicked off taking complaints, and we were then legally authorized to take complaints. I think we had, in luck, the slides have started working. We were legally empowered to take complaints from the 30th of September 2004. We are still new and still learning constantly about the various areas of financial services where there are complaints and what our intervention can do in those areas to help improve the level of consumer protection and integrity in the industry in which we've been mandated to intervene. And I think for this committee, consumer protection and the integrity of the financial services industry must be paramount. Let me start then, Chair, by giving this committee an idea of numbers. If you look at the first slide on the screen now, you will see that in the first year, 2004-2005, we saw something like 604 complaints and inquiries. When I say complaints and inquiries, I mean the whole batch of paper and queries that come into the office, be it in the form of justiciable complaints or just mere inquiries. That grew fairly significantly in 2005-2006 to 3806. And it grew even further in the year under review to 4,484. Now, the growth in complaints and inquiries is, I would say, a marginal growth of 18%. But if you look at the blue blocks, you will see that the complaints 666 and 1320 are those complaints that fall within the remit and the jurisdiction of our office. Those complaints we are legally obliged to deal with and pronounce on or settle. Those have grown significantly, I would say, by 98%. It's almost double in number. Now, we might want to pat ourselves on the back and say, wow, consumer education is working. People know now that they can send complaints to the Vice Ombud. That may be so, but I don't think, I would hesitate to say that it is in fact working. And we'll talk about that presently. The jurisdictional conundrums and the confusion that exists is very much there. And one has to be really, really very astute and clever to navigate through the minefield that is currently the jurisdiction within this area of activity. Understanding that there is a long-term ombud, there is a short-term ombud, there is a banking ombud, there's a credit information ombud, there's a national credit regulator, and the fines ombud, and the pension fund adjudicator. So it's a veritable minefield or a jurisdictional labyrinth, as we would like to call it. And we could also say, well, the system of referring complaints from one ombud to the other is working, but I don't think that is entirely correct because there may still be cracks in the system through which these complaints are falling because there's no mechanism to check whether the complaints that have in fact been referred to the various other institutions have been dealt with. And we make the point in the report, and we'll talk to that presently, that unless there is a single system, to an independent system for the entire financial services industry, this jurisdictional maze and confusion will continue. And even if the state recognizes sectoral ombuds as it has done in the FISOS Act, it will only prolong the confusion rather than eliminate the problem. Now, having said that, Chair, let me just give an overview of the complaints and inquiries that we have received. If you look there, you will see that which is in blue, 1,320, falls within the remit of the FISOS ombud. That which is in green, which is 2,998 complaints, or some 67%, falls outside the remit. In other words, we can't deal with those complaints by law. And those are the complaints we have to refer out. And, of course, 4%, which is a small percentage, is still outstanding in terms of CRF. CRF means complaint registration form. That still has to be filled in. The client has been given the form and said, give it back to us. And we're still assessing those complaints. That was as at year end. And again, there'll be somebody that will take you through in more detail on these, on this particular area. Now, again, Chair, if we want to add value or add a monetary value to the various settlements and determinations that we have made, and there might be this notion, can you hear? Yes. There might be this notion that the success of an ombuds office is determined by the amount of money that you've returned to the consumer. And if one panders to that notion, you will see that when we started out, in the first year, 464,000 some change. That's really from the 30th of September of that year to the end of that financial year. In the second full year, 2005-2006, it was 6.5 million. That then jumped to 10, just a little over 10 million. But I'm saying, Chair, that that is not really, and I do not believe that returning money to the consumer is simply the yardstick to measure the success of an office like the Python. But, and I want to quote what the Minister of Finance said in a forward to our annual report. He says that the work that we do is of enormous benefit to the financial services industry. And that cannot be quantified by simply adding up the number of determinations made in favor of complainants. But he says that our effect is much broader as we bring in those who are not in compliance with the Fines Act within the parameters of compliance. And I think that is a very important, and in fact captures the essence of why we are there and what Parliament would have intended us to be there for. I want to illustrate this with an example. Just on the 20th of September this year, and this is not in our report, we received a complaint from a pensioner in Durban saying that some 75,000 rand of his life savings was stolen, literally, by a bank broker, pretending whilst he's in the bank that he's taking this money to invest it in the bank. The total loss to that pensioner and to several others was something like 200 million. It's reported in the press. When that complaint came to us, it so happened, and it's coincidental, that a Sunday newspaper ran a story saying, this is what has happened. And this pensioner has complained to the Fines Ombuds. I remember a call coming to us to say, did a complaint reach your office? And we said yes, as we are obliged to do, because a complaint had in fact reached our office. And guess what? That complaint was settled almost immediately. We didn't even have to investigate. We didn't have to do a single thing. And more importantly, that's the statement that was made by the bank concerned. It said all legitimate claims by investors will be paid in full. And if one looks at the total body of claims, it was something like 200 million. That indicates, Chair, that the power of the office by its very existence is there for the benefit of the consumer. Now, that particular kind of activity falls within the brand of what we call financial scams. And you would have seen that we reported on a number of financial scams. And what the Minister has said in the report again, he says that the challenge remains, that those who are not financially literate are victims of these scams and they are seen as soft targets, and acknowledges that we have noted that a number of investments are in financial scams or sham investments, as the Minister calls it, and he says that the regulatory and prosecuting authorities have to deal harshly with the vendors of such schemes, but he also says that there is a need and a responsibility for greater consumer awareness. Now, Mr. David Davidson, my colleague, the Assistant Ombud, will take us through some of the areas of difficulty that we see in relation to consumer confusion. I won't talk about that at this stage. What I propose to do, Chair, in order that this committee understands our work and appreciates it, is to take you through some of the real case studies that we have seen, which we've either determined or have settled. Now, I just want to pause there to mention what is, in effect, a determination. A determination is a judgment. We sit and write it like you would write a judgment of a court. It has the same effect. It is deemed to be a judgment against the person against whom it has been pronounced. Now, as indicated in the report, we wrote in the year 15 detailed judgments. Now, for every determination or judgment that is written, there are many cases that are settled. And you will note that there were 442 cases that were settled in favor of the consumer. And of course, there was a greater number gets dismissed because they don't fall within the remit or there's no case. 1,520 were in fact dismissed. Now, I want to take you through some of these cases, Chair, so that the committee gets a sense and feel of what it is that we deal with. You would have noted in the report that we dealt with 7 cases involving trading or investments in the failed and defunct Forex services scheme, or scam, if I may put it bluntly, known as Leaderguard Spot Forex. What had happened there was Leaderguard Spot Forex, local South Africans set up an overseas trading arm called Leaderguard Spot Forex in Mauritius, a local marketing arm called Leaderguard Securities, SAPTY Limited, was set up in South Africa. It then solicited funds through agents and brokers from residents mainly from South Africa and partially from Botswana and a little bit from Swaziland. And what they did was this money that was collected, 300 million in all, was then taken across ostensibly to trade in Forex in Mauritius, and I think it found its way into other entities set up by the same scheme and found its way into other bank accounts and found its way into people's pockets. It is still the subject of investigation in relation to fraud and many other criminalities that could have been perpetrated by the people who were dealing with these issues. Our concern was the brokers who were recommending these products to consumers and saying, well, invest in this, it gives you a fantastic return, because they were also getting a fantastic commission on it. Now, what we did was, by drawing these judgments, and remember, a lot of them could be hollow judgments because these guys have gone under, people are still battling to get their money, and in fact there was only one, I think, was paid after we issued a judgment, and that was the Comrie decision where we said that the broker must pay. Now, we put the spotlight, I believe, Chair, and we raised public awareness on this conduct, and it is quite clearly spelled out that those who render financial services have to exercise extreme caution in recommending financial products without carrying out the necessary due diligence. I think the industry at large, those that belong to the bigger financial houses, understand that you can't mess around with these kinds of products. In fact, they would get fired if they did so. Now, we've done these judgments, and the business or the principles of recommending only those products which are recognized is not new. There's legal judgments in this country and internationally which says that you have to only deal with what is proper investment product. Of course, what remains to be seen is whether any further action will be taken against both those who perpetrated or set up these schemes and perpetrated this fraud upon mostly pensioners and those who recommend these products. Now, what we highlighted is the conduct of the brokers and the key areas of non-compliance, which I'll take you through very quickly. The product was inappropriate for the needs and circumstances of the clients. Most of them were pensioners. In almost all the cases, the provider was not licensed in terms of the FIES Act to render advice or intermediary services in Forex investments, yet they failed to disclose this to the public that they were dealing with. They did not understand the product. They said that it came with a stop loss of 20% and it was guaranteed, whereas that was completely incorrect information. The actual documentation revealed something completely different. It said that none of the money was guaranteed. The foreign Forex services provided that the Leaderguard Spot Forex registered in Mauritius was not recognized by the South African authorities, yet they recommended that product. The South African marketing arm, Leaderguard Securities, was operating only in terms of an exemption. Now, an exemption could have been withdrawn at any time. And if an exemption was withdrawn and said, listen, we're not approving your license, they would have had to return all the money. They didn't explain that to the people with whom they dealt. And naturally, if they had explained that, I think someone would be very silly to invest in that product in the first place. And the key driver, of course, was higher than normal commissions. And of course, the usual rules, they fail to display due skill, care, and diligence in recommending these products and placing their clients in such a risky product. Interestingly enough, in another case in which we also pronounced on illegal scams, there was a Christopher Pillay, a broker who recommended the investment in what a scheme created by...
And in relation to the ombud?
It's a Pillay with a Y. Interestingly enough, this Sunday paper carried an article, Broker Gambled Away Funds. The money was apparently gambled away at casinos in Durban. His boss, a guy called Mervyn Dennis, whittled away something like 84 million official money. And this guy, when he got caught, it was 585,000, but he was arrested immediately after he left court because somebody else complained that he stole their money as well. So that's the kind of thing that happens with these scams. He was struck off by the Financial Services Board from practicing as a financial services provider. And we are yet to see whether any further action will be taken against the brokers who recommended products in LeaderGuard Smart Forex. Another area that we might talk to in a little while is warranties. Sold very often at the motor dealer's floor, where you buy a motor car and it's tagged onto that product. Ms. Bam will talk a little bit more on it. We ruled in one such case. It was Zayed Hatiz versus Springs Car Wholesalers, where an unlicensed provider on the shop floor sold a warranty and said, don't worry, it's fine, you cover, take the car and drive it off. If there's anything that goes wrong with the car, it'll pay. When the person eventually claimed, because something went wrong with the car, they said, oops, we underlined or we ringed the wrong section of the warranty. It should have been section B, but we covered you under section A. And in fact, section A paid a bigger benefit and they relied on section B, and we said, doesn't work like that. If you read section BA, then you must pay under section A. It wasn't a large amount of money, but the principle is important. And we also criticized the product as being thoroughly confusing. And I think we had a call shortly thereafter from the underwriter saying, why are you criticizing the product? Now, that is one area where we see some problems. We'll talk about that presently. Another area that we always see problems is there's a failure to explain material terms, exclusions, circumstances under which the policy will not pay, and the loadings, exceptions, and the disclosure clauses. We ruled on one under appeal, Saroja Naidu versus SA Home Loans, where two insured were ostensibly insured in terms of credit life. It was on the back of a mortgage bond that they'd taken, and they only spoke to the wife, and in speaking to the wife, the conversation went something like, well, Mrs. Naidu, you know, there will be no payment if you suffer from any dread disease like cancer, etc., but you sound very healthy to me. And the woman said, yes, ostensibly, probably answering that she was, in fact, healthy. The reason that we ruled was that they never spoke to the husband. That matter is presently on appeal, and we're waiting to see what the outcome of that was. That's a matter that was determined. It was a case that's on our website as a case that is determined. There was another one that was settled, a Mr. Swart, who went to a motor dealer, two policies underwritten by a large insurance company. At the time of the sale of the vehicle, and during which the financial services also rendered, no explanation was given to the insured on the terms, conditions, loadings, exceptions, and the circumstances under which the policy will not pay. Yet, the product itself contained in fine print all the areas when it would not pay. And this gentleman suffered from hypertension for something like 10 years. Before he went to the motor dealer and bought this policy. He died. The daughter, who then reported the complaint to us, was the executrix in the estate, and she said her late father would never have bought these policies because he knew he's hypertensive. And they just simply put the policy in place. We intervened, and through a process of negotiation, we often negotiate, we got them to pay both the claims, and they settled in the sum of 207,106 rand. So that those claims were in fact paid. Here's another area of concern, unauthorized policy. There is a practice which is prevalent in this industry where consumers, and these are consumers who are mostly employed by government, they are healthcare workers, your teachers, policemen, and mostly in areas like rural KwaZulu-Natal, rural Eastern Cape, Northern Cape mostly, and what happens is that I would call them the victim of a fraud, the consumer, doesn't know that a debit is going through her account. I use the word debit quite broadly. It's actually a stop order that goes through the salary per cell. And when the victim eventually discovered that this money went through her per cell account, it's probably 6 months, 8 months, maybe 12 months down the line, she then goes and starts making inquiries. She starts with her HR department, and there's a delay by the time they discover what it is, and they say, oh, you've got a policy. And she says, what policy? I've never taken out a policy. And they say, well, you must go and check now with the insurance company. And then she starts inquiring with the insurance company. Now, by the time she gets to the insurance company and discovers which insurance company it is, who's the head office, what they have to do with it, and when it eventually gets reported to them, it's about 8, 12 months down the line. They then say, well, we'll investigate. They say, go and get an affidavit from a police station. And if you're talking rural areas, it is very, very difficult. They then go and get an affidavit and send it down. They are further abused in the system until eventually, maybe another 4 or 5 months down the line, they are told, well, we've investigated and we agree it's fraud. Here's your premium. That's all that gets done. The premiums are then refunded. Now, we have not yet determined, and we are in the process of looking at a case, but what I can tell you is this comes to us in batches from many of the major financial services houses in this country, and the point that we want to make here is, why isn't it stopped at entry point before it enters the system? So we're looking at a determination, and hopefully we will rule and give the South African public some kind of indication as to what happens in the system. And it happens with tied agents of these insurers, and it happens through independent providers. The difficulty, Chair, is they continue to do business with them. They still, the representative quietly slips away, and he probably goes and joins another financial services provider where the conduct may continue. And we've seen in cases they simply say, no longer, dismissed, not around. But we want to know what goes on. What are the checks and balances to prevent rather than react and simply refund the premiums? Because the consumer concern has been abused and continues to be abused on knowing that somebody has invaded her privacy in this way and slotted in a stop order without her even knowing about it. I think we counted this year about 86 of those. If you count from the beginning, I think there's been a large number. What would happen is the moment you refer, it gets settled by saying, oh, well, we discover it's fraud, we agree it's fraud, here it goes. But remember also, Chair, that prior to us coming into existence, this would have been a long-term insurance matter, which would have been dealt with by the long-term insurance ombudsman, and they've referred a number of them to us. But again, under consumer confusion, we'll tell you that a number of them have also been settled in that way via that office. Now, if in case this committee thinks that we only rule in favor of the consumer and not against the consumer as well, I can tell you of the numbers, the larger number gets turned away because it's either not falling within our jurisdiction or there's no prospect of success and the Act allows us to do that, or a court would be a better forum to deal with this matter, or that a proper or a decent offer has been made to you, so accept the offer, or where there's a dispute throughout, we would eventually determine, and the Act in terms of Section 28 says that we can determine this case. And that's where we go into a full inquiry into whether the financial planning aspects have been carried out. And let me give you one example of a case. This, and it's a Marina Plain versus Old Mutual, where the woman complained that when her husband died, all that was left was what she called miserable retirement annuities, which paid very little. And if only they had also recommended and advised her late husband to take out life cover, she wouldn't be sitting eking out a living on these, what she called, miserable retirement annuities. We then investigated that case fully. We went into the records of the provider concerned. We interviewed the agent who dealt with her, and he said, no way. I know this deceased. I dealt with him for about 26 years, and he did not qualify for life cover. Then we went and investigated that further. We discovered that, in fact, there was evidence which indicated that he had been for health medicals, what he called medicals, for life cover, and he was found to be hypertensive, and he wouldn't have qualified for life cover anyway. So it's an indication, Chair, that there is a level of fairness in what we do, and I think the industry has come to respect that and understand that. From the many presentations that I do, they have a high regard for the level of an unbiased approach that is taken by the office to ensure that the principles of consumer protection and integrity stand, but at the same time done in a fair and an unbiased manner. Chair, I want to hand over now to my colleague, Mr. Davidson, who will take this committee through the areas of confusion. And without further ado, let me ask him to just address the committee on that issue.
Mr. Davidson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and honourable members, when you look at the report, there's a piece titled Ensuring Consumer Confidence in the Resolution of Disputes in Financial Services, and that's on page 37 to page 40 of the report. And I would request that the members take the time to actually have a look at that. I think it's very informative, and it raises some very pertinent issues around jurisdictional overlap and the ability of the consumer to choose the appropriate forum. Basically, in what I'm going to talk about now, I'm talking about, if I just talk about my role briefly, as the role of the assistant ombud, I get to deal or look at firsthand a lot of the complaints that come in and play a role in sometimes deciding whether we deal with the matter or whether we should actually refer it out. So, in essence, I get to see the confusion at ground level. So, that's the sort of basis I'm thinking of and I'm talking from. We've got a slide here which shows the maze of consumer confusion. Really, you've got your various ombuds, CFA, banking, short-term, long-term insurance ombud, national credit regulator. And each of these have their own governing acts and terms of reference. Okay? In essence, what it means is, in simple terms, it means that there's certain provisions of the governing guidelines which determine whether that complaint, an actual complaint, would fall into their jurisdiction or not. Okay? And sometimes those can be subtle differences as to whether a complaint can be seen by them or dealt with by them or not. Okay. If you read that report on page 37 to 40, to a large degree there's an issue around consumer education. And I think I'd be one of the first to agree that consumer education plays a vitally important role. Okay. My major problem, however, is that in order for the consumer to fully understand what forum they actually need to go to, they have to really be fully conversant with all the applicable legislation and the terms of reference of these various forums in order to ensure that their complaint is at the appropriate place. Okay? I think also something that needs to be pointed out to the honourable members is that even with detailed knowledge of the legislation and the jurisdiction, the jurisdiction really between the various bodies is actually not that clear at the end of the day. In the sense that there's a bit of an overlap. We've got a number of complaints where there's an overlap in jurisdiction. And hence, one could effectively have two dispute resolution bodies dealing with the same complaint, or certain different aspects of the same complaint. It's a practical problem that not only we face, but some of the other bodies out there actually face. And in some instances, what I've actually done is I've referred a particular matter to one of the other bodies and said to them, requested them that they actually look at a certain aspect and then refer the matter back to us to look at, this, at another part of the complaint. It's really an unsatisfactory arrangement. It's a waste of time and it's basically just time consuming. You've got the FISOS Act, Financial Services Ombud Schemes Act, which makes provision for instances where there's uncertainty over jurisdiction. The problem with that, it sounds great in theory, but the problem is sometimes it's only when actually really carefully looking at a complaint and actually trying to investigate that you actually determine that maybe, we are not the correct form, it maybe needs to be referred elsewhere. But that might only be determined at a later stage. Of course, that creates a great deal of annoyance among complainants because they've come to you and they want their complaint resolved. They don't want to know that it's now being referred elsewhere or someone else is now dealing with it. Okay? I think a fine example of the consumer confusion is the Inca Lily case. If you can sort of crane your head to one side and let go to read the slide, but it's actually in the report. And I'll just read what this lady actually said when she sent in her complaint. damages to my plants due to compost mixed with my soil. I shall be pleased if you will advise if I may call on you for assistance as I'm facing a substantial loss to my Inca lily plants, which have died after adding compost to the soil. Okay? Whilst the example of Inca lily is perhaps an extreme one, the office receives many letters which show that the consumer is uncertain as to where the lodges of her complaint. And that's an extreme example, but a rather amusing one at the very best. We do get a lot of complaints where they refer not only to the complaint, not only to the office, but to all the other complaints you'll have. See all this, it'll be phase, onload, banking, onload, long-term, onload, short-term, onload, and we've had several of those, just to make sure that they're getting to the right forum. We also got a letter from a Mr. D.G. Cop, also, unfortunately, again, it's wrong, but the members have got the slides at least to look at. This one is an Afrikaans, and Afrikaans is not the best, but I'll basically try and roughly translate what this letter says. The Ombudsman for Short-Term Insurance asked me to refer this matter to you. My complaint is as follows. Talks about policy dates and then refers to a copy of the original policy. In the meantime, AIG changed the policy premium without my authority and without telling me what the improved benefits are. I get no answer from their client services. And the pertinent issue is the case was for more than a year at the long-term Ombud, and he could not get any reason as to why the policy is increased. After 1 year, AIG said to the long-term Ombud that it did not fall in their jurisdiction, but instead within the jurisdiction of short-term Ombud. Okay? Out of passive frustration, I asked to cancel the policy, but they ignored this and did not cancel it. My hope is now on you. Help, please. I'm already giving up and frustrated. Okay? In effect, what I'm pointing out there really is that, and this letter is not an isolated case, but I can assure the members, honourable members, it's clear that even industry experts have difficulty in ascertaining their jurisdiction in this matter. And having spoken to several colleagues within the industry, I know that's the case. I'm not just talking from the letters we've seen. We do know there's industry confusion out there. I can also say, and when we expect firms of attorneys to know who the correct bodies are, but on several occasions, as a matter of fact, numerous occasions, we get complaints from firms of attorneys on behalf of clients, which we have to direct to other forums because it's not the correct forum. So if attorneys don't know, I'm not too sure how the average chap on the street is actually going to know where the correct body is to refer a complaint. Also, the financial service providers themselves, that's the product providers themselves, wittingly, knowingly or unknowingly, refer complaints to the incorrect form. And that we've seen on, I've got letters from office I can bring out. And matter of fact, yeah, we've had recent ones of that as well. Again, if the experts don't know, how can the average chap on the street know? We've got a slide on statistics. We next one. Okay, basically, I think in essence, about 67% of the complaints that we get are actually referred out. And that's really just a breakdown of where they actually get referred to. Office Long-Term Insurance, National Credit Regulator, quite a few are directed, 72% are directed back to the financial services provider to deal with the matter. But essentially, that's a lot of matters that are referred out that have come back, that have come to us initially. It shows in essence, that shows the confusion. Okay, start concluding. Okay. I think in essence, we need to ask ourselves, we've got all these different bodies out there, whether by creating them, and these were done undoubtedly with the best of intentions in mind. But the question needs to be asked whether effectively we're actually really frustrating the intent behind the legislature. And in essence, I think it is regrettable that bearing in mind the vulnerable state within which most consumers find themselves, especially in a country like South Africa, that we should continue to have a plethora of forums essentially doing the same work, but with fine, and I say this, fine jurisdictional lines that differentiate who does what. In fact, Parliament has recognised this when it refers to uncertainty over jurisdiction in Section 13 of the Financial Ombud Schemes Act. Essentially, what is the object of so many forums if it's not simply to confuse? And I use that term, fine jurisdictional lines, because we've actually had a number of complaints in the office where people who know the system and understand the law craft their products and the way they actually do business in a certain way to make sure they don't quite fall within various jurisdictions. And it, you know, we're talking about some, we're dealing with money, and we're dealing with some very intelligent people out there. Other points I think I need, very strongly I need to make, is that one cannot lose sight of the enormous cost in manpower expended both in ascertaining the correct jurisdictional form within which a case falls, as well as the difficulties involved in actually educating consumers. Okay? In effect, if the experts with all the resources that they have available have difficulty in ascertaining jurisdiction, the question must be asked as to whether it is reasonably possible to comply with the requirements around educating the consumer given the myriad of jurisdictions. The Act basically tells us that we need to educate the consumer, but in my own mind, and it's a personal opinion, I question as to whether we can educate the consumer given the current maze of different bodies. When it, I think in most instances, requires someone with a great deal of legal technical knowledge just to understand the jurisdiction, never mind trying to explain that now to a person, let's say, in a rural area. I don't know if that's really possible without a huge amount of effort. In essence, whilst there being attempts to resolve this confusion, my belief is that this hasn't succeeded as of yet. And in fact, the steps have really only been stopgap measures along the way. You've had sort of phase activity, sort of recognizing all the bodies, but to me, I see that as stopgap measures. In essence, unless there's a common independent platform, the public will continue to suffer confusion in what the Ombud has described as a jurisdictional labyrinth or Ombud marketplace. We've stated that there's a need for a single port of call. Very importantly, the port of call obviously has to be independent and obviously has to have the appropriate powers. And in essence, I now believe that the time is right to make this transition, respectfully press that the honourable members of this committee give due consideration to the benefits, and I believe the benefits which we derive from a single entry point. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
I think Chair, Mr. Eugene Oakes, will take us through some more of the statistical information and just give this committee a sort of overview of what the near term looks like in terms of numbers.
Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, I want to say thank you for giving us the opportunity to be here. I don't want to waste your time and I don't want to be boring. That's why we're going to the more colourful issues like SET, which is very interesting. Let's just start off with the first one. You'll find on page 35 of our annual report, there's this one question, where do our complaints come from? Now, if we look at that, you'll see approximately where all our complaints come from, what provinces. Now note that that part there is based on justiciable complaints that fall within our jurisdiction. That's not all the complaints received, we're just taking a look at the justiciable complaints. You'll see that Gauteng is actually quite popular. Now, there's nothing wrong with it. If you think about it, they're the biggest financial hub of South Africa, and hopefully that's where you'll most probably find the majority of complaints. But hopefully we'll try and get it lower, but I don't think there's a marketing issue for people in that environment knowing who the phase ombud is. If you take a look at Western Cape and KwaZulu-Natal, it actually is, I think it's a bit low for the size of what they contribute to the economy. Now, there are two options. Either the first one is that the financial industry really knows what they're doing in those provinces and people are very satisfied with their products. Or the second option is that they don't really know who this office is. So we know that we've most probably got challenges. We're looking at Mpumalanga as well. It's also a big environment, especially if you take a look at Sasol and all those industries around the Eastern Cape Free State. So what I'm saying is we need to get our voice out there and maybe see if we can get the balances correct the way it's supposed to be. If we go to the next slide, what products do people complain about? Now, this is interesting. You'll take a look and you'll, once again, I'm going to reiterate, those are the complaints that fell within our jurisdiction. It's not out of our jurisdiction. These are the complaints within our jurisdiction. you'll see that investments, long-term insurance, short-term insurance, are all closely around about 25%, which is norm. I mean, they're the biggest contributors in the financial market. You'll find that it will both probably be 25% if you just work on all standards. Everybody's supposed to have a certain size of the market. Those aren't our worries. Our biggest concern that we've picked up, and if we specifically refer to this financial year, is the following. Take a look at that 2% at Forex. What we've felt is, what we've seen is that things that are small might have the biggest impact on the economy. Now, these are the scams that we're referring to the Forex. Of all our justiciable complaints, only 2% of them were related to Forex. But if you go back to our determinations, if you take a look at the financial impact that 2% had on the public of South Africa, then you realize that it's got nothing to do with the size of the market, especially those ones that we cannot predict or cannot control. Because big insurance companies, they normally come to the table. The reality is that they would normally come to the table if we have a chat with them. You'll find with the big investment houses, they don't want problems with the South African government or institutions or the regulators. But it's always these small ones that we battle to control or battle to find, that when they come out, it's massive, massive losses. Now, if we take a look at that hard forex, that 2% does not really represent the impact it had. The problem with those type of investments is it's using a lot, and I'm reiterating, it's using a lot of resources of the office due to its inherent complexities. You'll normally find that these scams are so creative, you're just doing the catch-up game from the start until the end, and you still continue. You'll never know exactly, and we need to try and curb that risk. We must also understand that it will always be scams. There'll always be people that are unscrupulous. You'll find people going out robbing people. That's part of life. All we need to do is just try and combat that. The biggest issue that we've got, though, is that the public, when we do a determination on one of these scams, they come to our office and they think we're the prosecuting authority. So what would happen is, they'll say, Mr. Pillay, you made a ruling against LeaderGuard Spot Forex. Now, Mr. Pillay didn't do a ruling against LeaderGuard Spot Forex as such. He commented thereon, but he was actually after the financial services provider for giving unethical business advice or giving unethical advice or leading a client into buying into that investment. So, in actual fact, that increases our workload exponentially, whereas these are actually issues falling under the jurisdiction of prosecuting authorities. We also note that, of course, scams, they continue to focus on the financially desperate, illiterate, the old, the greedy, the unsophisticated, uneducated citizen of the country. There's another issue that will most probably be raised by Mr. Luntupang. That's more on the short-term insurance industry side. What we've picked up is an actual fact that claims that short-term insurers think that they do not have to comply, not by licensing themselves in accordance with the FASE Act. They think that they don't have to comply according to the code of conduct because they're short-term insurers. Excuse me, and that's the situation that we currently have. They don't do financial planning the way that they're supposed to do. So they replace your one policy with another policy without actually explaining to you the differences between the two policies. Whereas the long-term insurers and the investment houses have come to the party easy. They understand the code. It's more the short-term insurer instances where they don't think they have to do it. We'll most probably have some determinations on that. Then another issue is that you've got compliance officers that are actually getting paid a lot of money by the brokers. What happens is they work on a basis of a tick box approach and saying, fine, we'll take all this information and we'll take it and we'll tick it, and if we tick it, it means the client knows, and if the client knows, and you give me that documentation, you're complying with the FASE Act. Where the problem is now is that you're sitting with compliance officers, and they might be professionals in law or whatever, but they might not have the basic understanding of financial planning. Now they would create these basic documents, and they would say, fine, if you do this, you comply. Now you'll find a broker doing that because he's trusting now his compliance officer. In the meantime, the compliance officer is actually leading the financial planner or the financial industry in not complying in actual fact. So we also have to do some determinations on that and get a good example of that as well. If we go to the next slide. Our new complaints were processed. That would be on page 10 of our annual report. That in actual fact is just a picture on this, on our annual, on the financial year end date, what we've done up to that date and how we process our complaints. We received a total of 4,484, like Mr. Blade previously said. And if we take a look at it, 77% in actual fact were resolved in the same financial year. What we mean by resolved would mean all the processing. If a complaint comes in, we either dismiss, we either refer, we either continue with it, investigating. But all, out of all complaints received, 77% have been closed off. So even if we refer it to other forums, 77% have been referred. All closed, formally. But now we're sitting with the next issue. Remember, you're sitting with a lot of complaints, and keep in mind, business continues into the next year. So if the year ends, we're not just closing off that year's files. Files get carried over, and that's normal business practice. We're sitting with a small team. I mean, with the caseload that we've got, it's a very challenging environment, and I really hold my hat off for the employees there. They're doing their best. The focus point there is the next step. 98% with all case managers, all people working in actual fact at the office, had a 98% increase in workload over the past year. That we expect on a conservative view, 92% for the coming year, between 92 and 157% increase in complaint volumes. We also need to remember that all these increases are without aggressive marketing of the office. So if we go there, then you must keep in mind what we can expect in the future. Now the expected growth for complaints based on the previous financial year, you'll see on the chart you've got 2007-2008, one based on a 44% growth, 54% growth. That 44% growth and 54% growth is not based on the 54% growth of your annual complaint. That's got to do with justiciable complaints increasing. Now, the most important part is that this office is going to grow exponentially. There's no two ways about it. Even if we take in consideration CECLs, if we take in consideration, if we go out and aggressively market this office, we will have to grow exponentially. And that's where we are growing. I know that we are employing new employees within the near future to try and get the equilibrium correct. If we increase, for instance, our jurisdiction or justiciable complaint by 10%, just by 10%, if it jumps by 10%, it increases our productivity or workload with 44%. For every 10% increase, it becomes 44%. 10%, 44. 10%, 44. So you're actually sitting with a fraction of 1 to 4. And remember, last year we based our growth on 29%. This year we're actually expecting the annual increase of around about 44% just in complaints. If we take our year-to-date growth in complaints. Last year was 29% in total. This year we're already sitting at 44%. So we already know the office is going to burst out of its seams. we must remember one thing, and the office actually realizes this, is that we are not measured against other ombudsmen, because we already know the public's confused. They don't know what ombudsman is the best or what do they actually use. The industry or the public out there, they would compare us against the financial industry. They don't compare us against the short term or the long term. They see us as the ombuds. The ombuds supposed to be as effective as the financial industry. And we know that. That's our measurement. In theory, we're supposed to be measured against other international ombud schemes with the same type of jurisdiction. Keep in mind, our jurisdiction is much broader than all the other jurisdictions of the other ombud schemes in South Africa. But our competition will still say the financial industry. So we need to make sure that we, the guys working at that office fine, first have the talent or have the skills upgraded, because the financial industry itself is a vast, quick-changing environment. You're sitting with financial products that actually is sometimes fatal to understand. And we have to make sure that the people working at our office are able to look at that, try and be the same level as the financial market. And remember that we always will be, any regulatory environment will always have a catch-up game. But we need to be as close as possible to the financial environment to make sure that we can actually regulate it in a much more effective manner. I want to thank you for the time. I'm going to give it over to Mr. Luther Brandt. She's going to say something very interesting about the short-term insurance industry, and you must enjoy your day. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. My colleagues and I prepared a piece on short-term insurance business. We didn't think it was going to be necessary to put slides up. The simple reason is that we all drive cars here. It's going to be very interesting to know what we don't know, what we should know about the cars that we drive, and what we ought to know about the insurance that we take for those cars. In very brief, when we talk of short-term insurance, we talk about insurance for objects, your house, insurance for your computer, insurance for your stock if you're running a business.
From that slide with the fire. So this slide.
Yes, this empty slide represents what we're going to say. Yes. You'll enjoy it. All right. We felt that the best way to communicate this message to you is to just use examples of the cases that we do. And we're going to look at the example of one Mrs. A. And I just want to say we can't mention the names of the people on the other side if the case has been settled without prejudice, okay? We didn't write out a judgment. It's not a public document, so we can't quote the name of the persons involved on the other side. Mrs. A bought a vehicle from a car dealership in Johannesburg, and then just before completion of the sale, she was told by the salesperson that she needs to obtain insurance for the vehicle. I think we all know that if your vehicle is financed, you cannot drive it out of the showroom if it's not insured. So she obliged and she took out the insurance. How did she do that? The salesperson just got hold of a broker over the phone, and the salesperson gave all the details to the broker over the phone about the car, and all that Mrs. A was required to give was her banking details, which she did. The premium was fixed at $654, and she drove out of the car dealer. Weeks and months passed without her ever hearing from the broker until in March. The sale was done in 2006 in November. In March 2007, her vehicle was involved in an accident. It was damaged beyond economical repair. Now it's time to lodge the claim. She does not even know who the insurer is. Fortunately, she could still remember the name of the broker. So she rang up the broker, and she lodged the claim through the broker. only to be told by the insurer that the claim is not going to be met because she was not upfront about her previous claim. Now, she recalls that the only detail that she was asking was a bank detail. So she starts arguing with the insurer. The insurer says, well, you're going to go and sort out with your broker. And the claim was not paid. Now, this is just one of the many problems that consumers experience when they deal within the area of short-term insurance. And it's partly because of their own ignorance. I'm sorry to say that. And it's also due to the shoddy services that financial services providers or brokers provide in this area of insurance. Now, if we actually look into detail what that client should have known, which she wasn't told, were the following. She didn't even know who the insurer was. She should have known who the insurer was. She did not even receive an insurance schedule or an insurance policy. Remember, the accident happened how many months after she bought the product? Almost 6 months or 5 months. She did not even know what excess was payable. Something as basic as an excess is what people would want to know. How much is my premium? And a lot of people don't often relate the premium that they pay against the excess. And the two are very, very related. She had not even confirmed the risk, where the car is going to be kept. It's often referred to as the risk address. The insurer, she didn't even know whether the insurer had that correctly. She did not even know in what instances is she going to enjoy cover and which instances is she not going to be enjoying cover. In other words, what are the limits of this insurance product? She did not know what safety requirements are required by the insurer. Often, people drive cars of various prestige and prices. And your insurer will often say, all right, your car is beyond X amount. I want to have a tracking device. I want to have a visa immobilizer. I want to have, you know, she did not have an idea of those things. Did not know, did not even have the opportunity to verify the accuracy of all details that the insurer had on their side. Remember, she's got no document. All she knows is the premium is 654. It's being deducted from a bank account. She's happy. She wasn't aware of what type of policy she has bought, she has purchased. She wasn't even told what commission is the salesperson going to earn for the shoddy service they're providing. To sum it up, this particular client had absolutely no idea of what she had bought at all. And she's comfortable. No, very happy in ignorance as well. And I want to talk to you now about another case which we resolved as well. An example of a Mr. Kulu. Again, the case was settled without prejudice. And we can't mention the name of the person on the other side. Yeah, what happened is this young man bought a brand new vehicle, BMW, for 289,000 rand. He put some extras on the vehicle, you know, tovers, gear locks, etc., etc. And those amounted to about 39,000 rand, which was to be added on the 289. He was advised by the salesman that it would be wise on his part not only to insure the car, but he also needed to take out life cover. And this form of life cover is called credit life. Just in case something happens to him whilst the vehicle is still, you know, being paid. So he obliged. So at the end of the day, what he walked out of that car dealership with was not just a car. He had a comprehensive insurance cover for the vehicle, which is mandatory because the car was financed. He had top-up cover. Now, top-up cover is the type of insurance that looks after you in the event that you have to quickly lodge a claim shortly after purchasing the car. Then you can't meet the finance charges, you know. So top-up cover will ensure that those are taken care of. And then credit life was insurance over his own life. The premium for the credit life was 14,500, which was also loaned to him and added to the capital debt. The top-up cover was 3,500 rand. And all that he was interested in knowing, like everybody that purchases the car, was how much is my installment going to be, he was told. How much is going to be the premium for the car, he was told. He drove out of the yard. Unfortunately for him, on the very same day that he took delivery of the vehicle, he was hijacked and assaulted. The car was never recovered, so he had to lodge a claim the very next day. When the claim was finally admitted by the insurer, he was shocked to learn that the car had only been insured for 289,000, meaning those extras weren't insured. Remember, he's been loaned that money to pay for those extras. They on their own, that amount on its own attracts interest. So what happens is that at the end of the day, he didn't even know what his exit was going to be. The insurer settled 255,000 rand, paid it over to the financiers. Mr. Kulu was left with a massive shortfall of about 89,000 rand. He didn't know where to get it from. And he was receiving letters that the matter is going to be handed over to the attorneys for the financing company. Then eventually, somebody said to him, you know what, there is an office that I think can help you. Go to the fire number's office. Our investigation of the matter revealed that this gentleman did not know how much his car had been insured for. And I can promise you, a number of people have probably gone through that. They just know that they've got insurance. They haven't seen the actual document to look at how much are they insured for. He had no idea what excess was payable in the event of a claim. He did know his insurer, but he did not know what the terms of that insurance were. He was not aware of what exclusions or limitations that were imposed by the insurer. According to him, there had been no discussion surrounding the finance products whatsoever. He was told that he needs to have insurance for the car. He was told that he must take out the credit last just in case something happens to him, and he was told to take out the top of cover. That was all the discussion that he had about those products. And he signed off, only happy to know what the installment is, confident that he's going to meet it, and the premium, confident that he's going to meet that as well. He didn't even know what the purpose of the top-up cover was. As a result, when he was confronted with that shortfall of 89,000, he believed that the top-up cover insurer must pay all of that, and it wasn't the case. When our office got involved, we then started questioning each and every single one of the providers that we involved in. Okay? How did you sell the credit lines? Did you follow the Fines Act? How was the top-up cover sold? Did you follow the Fines Act? You know, each and every person that was involved in the game had to answer some questions. And as a result of that questioning and pointing out to people that the Fines Act had not been complied with, that 14,500 rand for credit life was reversed and the interest adjusted accordingly, the broker who did not bother to ensure that the vehicle was correctly covered for the right amount also had to take responsibility and pay some portion of the shortfall. And of course, the top-up cover people eventually also played their role. So what Mr. Kulu was left with to pay was the excess, which everybody has to pay if you lodge a claim. Although he had the shock of knowing that it is now 21,000 rand. It was still better than 89,000 rand. Okay? The above is just the tip of the iceberg. These are problems that are inherent within the short-term insurance industry, especially how people sell these products. Then there's a whole different ballgame about warranties, which are sold to consumers of second-hand vehicles by car dealerships who sell hopelessly faulty vehicles to consumers. In these instances, all that the person is told is that, look, you know, if you have any problem on this car, this policy will look after you. In the meantime, the limitations of the policy and what it actually covers are not explained to the consumer. They only have to know when they lodge a claim. That, listen, you know, your car was bought with a mileage of 120,000. So the limit we can pay in that instance is about 1,500. and the claim from the panel beta or whoever is going to see the car is probably about 20,000. They now have to learn for the first time on that day that this product is actually going to take them as far as 1,500 trains. Now, these are just general things that people have to deal with. These are problems. In addition to these ones, we can mention the following. Consumers run the risk of having their vehicles covered, even though they do not know what type of cover they have. Okay? They can believe sometimes that they have insurance on their vehicles when they absolutely don't have insurance. Okay? It's not unusual for us to receive a complaint from a consumer who believed for about 6 months that he had insurance when he actually didn't have insurance. Only to learn on the day that they want to lodge a claim that they in fact are not covered. Consumers run the risk of buying credit life without being told the scope and the limitations of these products, because these products often come with very sharp limitations and exclusions, and people have to be told about those limitations so that they can know what they are buying into, but they often are not told. People buy these warranties, which I've just referred to, on motor vehicles, mostly when they buy second-hand vehicles, without being told exactly what the warranty is going to cover. All that they are told is that, look, buy this warranty, you'll have peace of mind. Until the first time that they actually lodge a claim, they know that they did not have peace of mind at all. Consumers often do not know what contractual terms have been imposed by the insurer on them. They often have no idea what safety requirements are required by the insurer. They sometimes believe that they are insured at a particular premium when a different premium is going to be deducted from their bank account. They may have insurance on their vehicles, but they may be grossly underinsured. And people often get to know when they lodge their claims that they are actually underinsured. Now, some of the root causes that we have identified, and we feel that there's a need not only to educate the providers or the broker that function in this area, there's a serious need to educate the consumers as well. What we find is the brokers themselves have not the slightest clue of what responsibilities are imposed on them when they sell this product by the FIRES Act. They do not believe that they are subject to the jurisdiction of the FIRES Ombud. They'll often argue with us that they must go to the short-term insurance ombud if there is a case. And I'm not sure what the reason for that is. Some brokers simply don't care. We can just put it at the level of they are away, but they just don't care. There is a large-scale reluctance to conform to regulations and what is legally acceptable standards of selling insurance to consumers. Some brokers still prey on the ignorance of consumers. That's another reason. If they see that you don't understand, they'll take the greatest advantage. Some brokers use old-age tactics of shifting the blame wholly to the consumer without being aware of what responsibility is demanded of them by the FIRES Act. When we ask them to submit records of the financial service they've rendered, in terms of the FIRES Code of Conduct, you're supposed to maintain records of what you've discussed with your client to prevent this push and pull when there is a dispute of saying, well, I did tell you, and the consumer says, but you didn't tell me. We often say to the brokers, well, give us the records that you should have maintained. And nine times out of ten, they are not there. They'll simply give you the proposal form. And we tell them, we don't want it. This is the document to contract. We want the compliance papers. We want you to show us that you have discussed this with your client. And often those are never produced. The people that sell financial products sometimes are not even authorized to do so. It's not unusual. You do find people that are working in the area of selling financial products, but they don't have the license to do so. And I think consumers also aren't aware of what service they are entitled to, the level of service they are supposed to expect from brokers. Consumers often don't know. They just accept anything. which is why we feel there's a need for people out there to be educated on these things. And last but not least, there's another very serious problem that we pick up, which now compounds all the other problems, all these things that we've just spoken about, is that a person very often speaks to one person, a broker. They'll say, well, I need an insurance for my vehicle. And from there, the person will think that's as far as the deal goes, not knowing that the broker is going to pass on some of those cases to somebody imposed in the middle called an administrator or underwriting manager. And from there, there'll be someone else that is the premium collector before the entire business gets to the insurer. Now, the question we need to ask ourselves is, who is paying all these people? From whose money are all these people paid? And is it necessary to have all these people in the chain of providing this service? Why can't it be as simple as when we buy insurance for our life, we know that you bought with Company X. You will see the name of Company X deducting money from your bank account. Anybody that's got life insurance, you look at your bank statement, you'll see there's Mutual, there's Liberty, there's whoever's selling the business of long-term insurance products. They'll be coming out of your bank statement with their name. With the short-term insurance, this is very difficult. You'll see one name, you think you're insured with somebody else, but someone else is deducting from your bank account. Why can't it be kept as simple as that? Money from the consumer, straight to the insurer. Why? That's it for me. Thanks very much for giving us this time. And thank you, Chair.
Okay. Chair, just by way of conclusion, before the committee ask questions, I think you've heard, Chair, that the work that we do covers a vast area. Doing the same thing. I think it's behaving now, Chair. Now, we deal with a wide range of financial products, and in respect of many thousands of financial services providers. If you add to that the recently enacted FITOS legislation, we have added jurisdiction. Of course, the National Credit Regulator could also refer complaints to the relevant ombud. You see, there's a vast amount of work to be done. And from what we've told you, I can say, as heading that office, that we've only just begun. We're only beginning to scratch the surface as far as our mandate in terms of the current legislation is concerned. It will take some time before our presence and the work becomes firmly embedded in the financial services landscape. That's our vision. I believe we've made a difference, but I think we've only just begun to make that difference. We've still got a long way to go to ensure that consumers get a fair deal from the financial services industry. And I say this in all my presentations. The consumers need to have confidence in both the advice that they receive and the products that they purchase as a result of the advice. This committee would have heard examples that we've given. We need to be constantly mindful, or the industry needs to be constantly mindful of the fact that they have to treat the consumers fairly. And in doing so, we might then be able to achieve that retail distribution market where clients are capable and they are confident. The information is clear, simple, and understandable. The practices that the financial services providers have are soundly managed, properly resourced, and that they treat their clients fairly. This, Chair, is a principles-based approach. Unfortunately, regulation is rigid, and until the industry gets the principles right, we will still have these battles on our hands. I want to conclude with that thought, Chair, and I take it this committee will want to ask questions.
Thank you. We've now heard what your office does. We've also been briefed as to the fact that, as you've indicated, you've just on this question surface, but also I think one of the things that come out strongly
is the issue of the confusion with regards to the number of ombuds, but also the legislation, as I mean, that regulates. And I think it's one of the things that this committee at some point would have to look into, because a number of those also report to this committee, and but some of them to other committees, as the new legislation, the NCA, would have established the credit regulator, national credit regulator, but the others all fall within the ambit. But it's something that would have to be looked into. In your report, you also have reported on some of the targets you had set yourself up in your business plan, and you report on those as well in the report. And I see also that you have also been addressing a number of your stakeholders recently, which is a step in the right direction. But it would be interesting to know, I'm not too sure whether I missed it in the report, whether if these are by invitation, whether there are any other outreach programs that you have to try and make sure that consumers out there know that they have this recourse in when they are being exploited, which continues on a daily basis. But also, it should also be interesting for the committee to know what is your average turnaround time for the complaints, because I would imagine if you listen to the process that that takes place, some of the consumers might have even lost patience, waiting for your complaint to be dealt with could take a bit of time. And I saw that a number of the determinations that you had made, most of them are on appeal. Some you had refused leave of appeal, but then the chairperson of the board had granted leave to appeal. That's, I would imagine, is one of the frustrations that your office and the consumers out there actually, places them in a difficult situation when, you're waiting for an appeal. And most of them, the date has not even been set at the time of writing the report. The date of the hearing of the appeal has not been set, and yet you had made a determination and refused leave to appeal. But then above you had granted leave of appeal, and the person continues to appeal, and the date has not been set. These are some of the frustrations I pick up from the report. Members, questions, comments? Mr. Afia, Ms. Fox, Mr. Singh.
I'm not sure there is a cry of caffeine. Maybe after we've asked these questions, the chair has a program that will.
Mr. Singh, did you hear the trolley? Did you hear the trolley? Can somebody just check whether the caffeine is ready so that we can quickly break for tea and come back, because I don't know where is it there? Okay, seeing that it's there, let's break for 10 minutes and then we'll come back and take questions.
Thank you.